Welcome to This Is My Life on 103.1 3BR FM. I'm Lisa Timms and I'm talking today with Marissa Yeaman, poet, singer and songwriter from Warrigal. Marissa, you moved around a lot in your early life.
Yes, I did, Lisa. I was born in Echuca and my family came off a property up there and we sold our house and packed up. I think my parents kind of got that wanderlust and wanted to head off and see somewhere apart from where they'd lived all their life. And they packed us up in a caravan, my sister and I, and the four of us took off around Australia. What we originally intended to be a 12-month trip turned into 4 years pretty much. And so I got to see a lot of the country, a lot of the outback, and we lived in all the different states as we went around. The older I get, the more I look back on that time and realise what a great help that was to me as a writer. And I think also kind of rounds you in a different way as a person too, because I think I got to see people in all sorts of backgrounds and all sorts of lifestyles.
What place made the most impression on you?
I'd have to answer that with two, I suppose. I think definitely outback, because the people that you meet in the outback are like people nowhere else in the world. There's just a really resilient race of people, very open and very friendly and welcoming. I think there's something about the open spaces of the outback that really touches me, and I really enjoy that, the space and the freedom and the peace to life that's out there. I mean, to me, the desert's alive. We used to pull up and look around and see. You've got to get out of the car and look to see what's there. And I think the Australian outback's just something that's totally unique.
Were your parents working?
My father was a builder, so we used to. If we got to a major city, then Dad would work and we'd head off and do trips from the... We'd leave our... Because we travelled with a huge caravan. We'd roll into town and everybody would look, because it was a 28-foot caravan. And so it wasn't easily missed. And so we would park that somewhere in a major city and or in a major country town, and then we'd do trips out from there, because we had an F-100 with a canopy on the back of it, and it was... Dad had decked it all out so that us kids could sleep on a bunk in the back, and yeah, so we'd get out and travel around in that and go off for day trips or week trips in the vehicle and leave the caravan back somewhere else. And yeah, and another time that was I think a very strong memory of childhood is we spent quite a number of months on a oyster farm up in northern New South Wales, and that was quite an isolated place, and it was about I think it was around about 20 or 30 k's to the nearest town. And at the time, because my sister and I did correspondence school, the people that we were living with, we had met in Cairns, and they'd asked my father to do an extension on the house, so we came down and stayed with them on the oyster farm. And during that time, I just remember they had a great lifestyle, the kids that lived there. They had paddock bombs and motorbikes and boats and all sorts. They, out the front yard, you literally opened the front door and looked at the ocean. And just the games that we used to be able to play, we could wander off for hours.
And when did you begin singing and songwriting?
Well, at the age of 13, my father was killed in an accident here in Gippsland. And I think I started to write as, looking back now, I think as a way of dealing with that, with the grief of that situation within me. It was something that, it wasn't a conscious process. It just was like it needed an outlet and it found its way out. And so I started to write a journal, it started as, and then as time passed on, things evolved into songs, and then it wasn't just writing about grief, it was writing about all sorts of things, and it just somehow triggered like a compulsion to write. I'd learnt guitar at 7. I'd been started off with some classical guitar lessons. My family, my mum and dad, loved music, so it just passed on to my sister and I. And so I had been started with classical guitar lessons and found it too regimented. And even though I enjoy classical music very much now, learning through structure was not kind of where my head was at that time. So I learnt for a couple of years, and then I put it down, and it wasn't until I was about 15 I picked it up again, because these words that were there in this book compelled me to want to put music to them. And so then I taught myself to be able to accompany and try and structure these songs that I was starting to hear in my head. And then it took me a number of years before I actually got out and played live. So, yeah.
Where did you do that?
What I consider my first live show where I was actually playing my own songs would have been in High on Chapel down in, it's Paran in Melbourne, yeah.
And where did you go from there?
Just a number of gigs around, I've played hundreds of gigs around Melbourne and through the state and also interstate, just developing the craft and getting used to it, because it wasn't something that came very naturally to me, standing on stage in front of people. I was quite shy, and it took a bit of coaxing from some friends to actually do anything about it. And so, you know, I started out sort of staring at my shoes and and progressed through playing a number of shows to the point where, you know, now I enjoy the experience. I'm very comfortable with an audience and love playing live. Quite often you'll find people that write, it's more of a solitary thing to be a writer. It's and you don't usually find that they're the personality types that like to stand up and be loud and be the centre of attention. So it's a bit of a paradox to make them stand up there and perform. So yeah, that takes some getting used to.
But at your third performance, you were voted runner-up in the Australian Female Roots Vocalist of the Year Awards.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't know I was in an award. I played down at the Warrnambool Festival of the Sea from memory, and yeah, and there was an awards thing, and I was I got runner-up in the Female Roots Vocalist, and I was very surprised, and yeah, it was fantastic.
Do you only sing your own songs?
I mix in every now and again. I'll throw in a song of somebody that I respect, and you know, I'm a fan of songwriters, so yeah, I find that, you know, it's nice to take somebody's song and interpret it in your own way. But mainly it's my own songs is what compels me to work and stuff. So
what are the main sources for your material now?
Oh, all sorts of things. Things that I've seen. I've since then done some travelling overseas, and I was also a competitive speed roller skater for a number of years and did a fair bit of travelling with that throughout Australia. So I kind of got back to most of the places that I'd been before. Plus I'd done some overseas travel. So quite often, I think songs, I write in a very, very wide range of subject matter, and a lot of it's personal experience. I still, you know, I think most songwriters use it as a way of understanding the world we live in, whether that be what happens to you, what's happening to somebody else around you, whether that's trying to understand society as a whole and the way that society reacts to something. I usually find if it's something that moves me personally, then I'll feel compelled to write about it. And sometimes it can be something completely different. It might be some words that just start coming into my head when I'm driving the car. And I'll look at it later and go, that's the start of something here. I'm obviously subconsciously working through a thread of something, or it can be a title that might start the song off. I recently wrote a song that's called Old Hotel Phone, and it was written. It was a strange one because that actually was the sound of my phone broke down at home, and I had to plug in an old-fashioned phone. And just hearing that phone when it used to ring made me actually remember back to a time I spent in a hotel in Mexico City. And so this song evolved quite a few years later about this moment in time that something had been triggered by the sound of this phone.
Do you have a huge collection of songs that you haven't recorded yet?
Yeah, I do. I have a huge collection of songs that I don't know that I write fairly regularly, and I sort of tend to move forward, and I had quite a few hundred songs before I got to do my first album, and so whether I'll ever visit some of those and bring those back or not, it remains to be seen. But yeah, there's a lot of songs, and when it came to picking songs for the album, I'd narrowed it down to about 36 songs, and I gave those because it's really hard for me to pick them, because as the writer I'd be closer to some than It's hard to keep objective about things, so I gave some CDs to Andrew Pendlebury, who was co-producing, and also to Ed Bates, and said, "Here, guys, help me whittle this down." So we ended up, we'd whittled it down to, I think, about 15 tracks that we went into the studio intending to record, and in the end, I whittled a couple more out, and so it came down to the 13 that ended up on the CD.
Is this your first album?
It is my first album. I've done a couple of EPs prior to this. Yes, it was, but there was a 4-year break between the last EP and this album.
What's your favourite on this one?
Oh, my favourite changes all the time.
Which most reflects you?
I would say probably No Fences is the one that talks about my childhood and my family life.
You spent the later part of your growing up in Warrigal.
Yeah, from about 9 until around about 15 I was in Warrigal. Then I sort of started to drift away a little bit because I was skating in the Australian team and I was spending time in Melbourne part of the week, so my mother was driving me up and down the highway at ridiculous hours of the morning and to get to training and stuff like that. So I sort of, and then I eventually moved to Melbourne.
What brought the family down this way?
Well, when we were coming back from around Australia, we came into, and I still can distinctly remember the first day that we drove over the back of the Strezleckis here and saw Warrigal sitting down in the valley. And I think we were just here, and while we were here, Dad was offered a job. So we stayed, and then we ended up, we bought a block of land and started to build a house. And then when my father got killed, my mother stayed here since. So it's just, I think, circumstances that brought us to stay here, but it is a beautiful, beautiful part of Australia.
Marissa, your CD, Pure Motive, is not done in a commercial way.
No, it's actually, it's a little bit of a step back in the opposite direction because I think the journey that I'd been through in the music industry at that point, I'd been sort of put in a situation where people were very much encouraging me to push into the pop market and go off and take a different tack to what I guess my instincts were telling me. I had had a couple of starts at the album where I'd been put with producers to work with that were industry producers, and they basically would look at my songs and see the pop presentations that they could do with them, and I sort of would come out of the studio with a finished product, and everyone would be going, that's great, it sounds like a hit, and I'd just have this uneasy feeling about it, because to me it wasn't where I wanted it to go. And I guess there came a point in the middle of all that I sort of said to myself, well, I'm the person at the end of the day that's got to stand up there on the stage and sell these songs, and I wanted it to be more honest. And so I sort of pulled away from that whole thing and took a bit of time to sort of regroup myself and surrounded. In that time, I'd been doing some writing with Andrew Pendlebury prior to that we'd known each other for about 6 years, I think, at that point, 5 or 6 years, and we did some writing, and the songs that were coming out of that were done in my home studio, they were just done very honestly and very sparsely, and I just sort of said, that's what I want my album to be like. I just want it to be very stripped back, organic, real, and capturing, you know, the live performance and the passion that comes from live performance. And so from that point, I just sort of went about gathering musicians that I really respected. That I there's a hell of a lot of great musicians in Melbourne that are not household names, and you won't see them on pop stars, and they are world class, and they're just playing in, you know, in pubs on corners in Melbourne any night of the week that you care to go and have a look. And these are the sort of people that came in and worked with me on the album, and we all had a really pleasing time. It was a pleasure to make the album. We really had some great times, and I think in some ways that comes across on the album, because you can sense that heart that is there. That musicians, at the end of the day, music is a celebration of life, and when people get too clever in the studio and polish things up and package music for commercial reasons, it loses something, and I wanted to work the album through to be to capture some of that heart that you get when you go to a live performance of a band. You sit there, there's an if you love music, there's an actual reaction that happens in your body. It's just you know, when you can feel the bass drum or the kick drum, you know, sort of reverberating through your body, or you can feel the warmth and the lushness of the bass guitar around you, or those sorts of things. And that spontaneity that comes with live performance that you just don't get off most records. And I think I figured out that was the thing that I was hearing that was missing in all these prior recordings that had been made of my music, was that whilst the songs were there, and the notes were technically there, but a lot of the heart wasn't. So that was what I was trying to aim to do with Pure Motive.
What's been the industry response?
The industry response has been quite amazing, really, because I sort of expected to be completely rejected because, you know, I didn't fit radio format. My songs had gone over 3:30, and you know, it wasn't it didn't have dance beats, and it wasn't aimed at the pop market and stuff. But the response from radio and also people within the industry has been really, really promising and really encouraging. So the nice thing is that I think through that process of leaving a lot of stuff out from the recording, it allows the songs to shine, and that's, to me as the writer, I think that was the most important thing, was that people could hear the seed of the song and take something from that, because it's the songs at the end of the day that communicate with people.
What's Andrew Pendlebury's background?
Andrew is best known for his time with the Sports. He was the guitarist in the Sports. And he's gone on to do a couple of solo albums, one which he won an ARIA for in, I think, about 96. And he's played with Chris Wilson's Crown of Thorns and any number of Australian artists. He's a fantastic, very unique guitarist. There's something in the writing process that works really well with that combination, and it's almost like a two voices kind of thing, because Andrew's a very illustrative guitarist.
Tell us about your home studio.
One of the tracks on the album was actually recorded in the home studio, but it was very small and makeshift at the time. It was actually my old manager from Sydney had lent me his 8-track digital desk, and I'm not a great technology head. I tend to I'm learning. I know my way around Pro Tools and bits and pieces, but I sort of tend to shy away from it a little bit because I think sometimes too much technology steals away from the actual process of making the music itself. So I kept the studio fairly simple, but one of the tracks on the album was actually recorded in my home studio and went on the album as it was recorded. We were actually jamming one night. We were sitting around with a single mic in the middle of the room, and we were jamming on a song, Andrew and I, and I actually stopped him and said, "Hang on, I think I can hear a piano accordion." And he just looked at me and like brought the eyebrows down in disdain, and a piano accordion. And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, have you got one?" And I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I do." And so I went off and got it, and came back, and we continued to jam. And later on, we hit the tape and recorded this section of music that just, there came a point, and when you actually listen back to the original recording, there's a point where we just clicked into place and just played, and that became the song Gasoline and Fire. And when we came to record that for the studio, we sort of listened back to the original recording, and at the end of it, I sort of said, "Well, I don't know if we should re-record it, because I don't know that we will capture the same spark that's there." Because you can get all technical about it then, and you start to iron little bits and pieces out. And, so the spontaneity of it was the reason that we sort of kept it and put the original recording onto the CD.
Has your sound been likened to anyone in particular?
Oh, over the years, I think I've been compared to just about every female artist in the book. And I've come to the conclusion that I'm just me. I think as far as everybody takes on influences of obviously the sort of music that they listen to or they like, and if my voice sounds like anyone, then that's purely coincidental, because I'm not a great, I can't say I'm a fan of voices as such. I'm more a fan of songwriters, and I like a lot of the singer-songwriters that came out of somehow particularly the West Coast of America in the 70s, and they're people that I kind of went back in retrospect and discovered, and writers like Jackson Brown and Joni Mitchell and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. I think, you know, probably in some ways I often ask how did I get interested in that sort of music, and I think probably because my father was a big fan of Cat Stevens. He loved Fleetwood Mac, Lobo, who was another American singer-songwriter. And he also loved instrumental guitarists, which is quite funny because I'm very drawn to that. And that's why the element of Andrew's playing in my music seems to fit perfectly to me, because I think that's probably what I grew up hearing. And then there's a lot of new stuff that I really love. I'm very big fan of a lot of the alternative country writers like Lucinda Williams and Ryan Adams, and there's also another lady called Mary Gaucher that's a very very colourful and visual kind of writer.
Is this album in any way a tribute to your father?
I think yeah, I suppose not particularly. The songs themselves would not be, you probably couldn't sit back and say, "Oh yeah, that's particularly inspired by my father." But the whole process has been part of the journey, I think. And I think, you know, this is just the start of the road.
What do your mother and sister think about your musical career?
They're both very encouraging. My sister actually handles my mailing lists and does some promotional stuff for me, and my mum's a piano teacher, and she's always been very supportive of my musical career. So it's pretty great. Good. I haven't got a family saying, "Get a real job."
When you're not writing or making music, what do you do?
I'm a graphic designer. by day. I actually ran a business with that for quite a few years before I kind of backed out of that to get serious about music, because I think the older I get, the more I look at things and feel that it's very easy to get caught up in what people feel they're supposed to do with their life. And I think a lot of people that are inclined towards the arts, sometimes it's like there's something tapping you on the shoulder going, I'm here, don't ignore me. And I very much felt like that. I felt like the whole time that I was sort of establishing a career, there was this nagging thing with the music. I was going home at night and writing songs and still not playing live and doing anything with it. And I was just lucky that I drifted into mucking around with a bunch of friends, and we used to get together and play and just play cover songs. And then one night I actually plucked up the courage to walk in and play one of my songs. And the strange thing, one of the people that was in that room is a friend of mine that has now become my manager. All these years later, she is my manager. And they didn't even know I wrote songs. I played with them, you know, on a social basis and never told anyone that I wrote songs. Because I guess until you can put anything out there, you wonder whether you're any good or not. So this particular night, I plucked up the courage and played a song to these friends, and at the end of the song, they all stood against the wall just looking at me. I thought, oh no, was it that bad? And this friend that is now my manager piped up with, what are you doing here with us? And so consequently, after that, they all kind of got on my back and said, you've got to go into a studio and start recording some of these songs and do something about this, you know, and pitch it out there and see if it is any good.
So you've given up your day job?
No, I still have my day job, but it works around my music. It works the opposite way around now.
Tell us about one of the tracks, Solid Ground. It's a take on Bob Dylan.
The thing with Solid Ground was that I'd woken up one night and written down like what became the first verse, and I still didn't know in myself what this was about, you know, how it connected to a thread of a song or something. And then not so long later, Bob Dylan was touring, and I was kind of sitting back and watching all the press that happened around him, and he was just so dismissive of the whole circus that kind of happens around him. And I was looking and I was just thinking, it must be his way of, in his reaction to the situation is probably his way of dealing or staying real. So the song was written about Bob Dylan looking out at the world, looking in at him.
Of stunning new disciples, parts when you walk in the room, chime of recreation, it's a subtle wake-up call, it's only in your own blood, they see the writing on the wall. Banking on the fortune tellers to come out good for you, while the adoration of a thousand pair of eyes is testimonial proof, profit for the masses, rattle that ball and chain, it's a heavy weight to bear, the benchmark of your name. Outside the glass like a traveling exhibit, reading lips of opinions cast, you walk in your own shadow, you're waiting to get wise, that you hold the Ten Commandments while faithful and alive.
Do you often get inspiration waking up in the night?
Well, a lot of writers say that you know, when in that stage just before sleep, sometimes you know, it's like when the mind lets go of the conscious and it's not quite off into sleep state, there's things that pop up there, and so it's always good to have a piece of paper beside the bed. And
does your poetry get much of an airing?
Funny that you ask, because I've just recently finished the first manuscript of a poetry book, so we're looking at maybe putting that out within the next year. It's a collection of poems, poems that weren't meant to be songs, and
is
also
that the title?
it hasn't really got a title yet. I haven't finalised what I'm going to call it. But and it's a collection of I also take black and white photos.
You've been listening to This Is My Life on 103.1 3BR FM. I'm Lisa Timms, and I've been talking today with Marissa Yeaman, poet, singer and songwriter,